Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt-Baker, Virginia gubernatorial candidates Terry McAuliffe and Brian Moran, AFGE District 2 National Vice President Derek Thomas, and AFGE local presidents Paul Ferris and Robert McNeil. We're also airing in Macon, Georgia on News Talk 940 WMAC, made possible by AFGE Local 987, and in Salt Lake City, Utah on KSL News Radio, made possible by AFGE Local 1592. We've been joined by Arlene Holt-Baker, Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO. Welcome to Inside Government.
Thank you so much.
So let's talk a little about the Employee Free Choice Act. How is that good for America?
Well, I tell you, it is good for America because if workers have the ability to bargain for their wages, their health care, and pensions, it only helps to help the middle class. As we know, our wages have been stagnant in this country for too long. Workers have, the productivity has been up, yet their wages have not increased. So the Employee Free Choice Act will give workers who want to freely form and join unions the opportunity to do that. And in a union, they will have the opportunity to bargain.
Now let's talk a little about the process currently and how it's been working over the past 8 years or more, really. What have been the problems with organizing and what's the need for the Employee Free Choice Act?
Well, the problem as it exists now is it really is in the hands of the employer. Workers who decide that they want to have a union, they usually end up having to go through a union election. But the process of getting through that to that union election, what we find is workers are intimidated, they're harassed. 25% of employers whose workers are engaged in union organizing end up firing one or more workers. Workers are forced to go to captive audience meetings. They're forced to have one-on-one meetings with their supervisors where they are illegally told that they could possibly lose their jobs or that plants will be closed. So all kinds of intimidation and harassment exist. We've got to get that out of the system and put it in the hands of workers so that if the majority of the workers in the workplace decide that they want to have a union, they should be able to do so. And they should be able to decide that they want to do it without employers being involved in it.
Now, a lot of people claim that the election would go away under the Employee Free Choice Act. That's not true, is it?
That is absolutely not true. The Employee Free Choice Act, whether it is an election or if it is majority sign-up of the workers, it would be in the hands of the workers. The workers would make the decision and would have the decision, and not the employer. This just, the Employee Free Choice Act is just that. It gives the employees the right to choose which method they want.
Now, I heard somewhere that employers were talking about spending something like $200 million to defeat this legislation. What are they afraid of?
Well, that's the question that we ask ourselves every day. What are they afraid of? We know that there are 60 million working Americans who say that they would freely form and join a union tomorrow if they could. Why are these employer groups so afraid of workers being able to go have a union and to bargain for their wages, hours, and working conditions? I think they're afraid of a balance of power in this country, and I think that they are afraid of shared prosperity that we know would come if more workers had the right to have a voice in the workplace.
Now, for employees that maybe work in a non-unionized sector, they would benefit from this as well by having more unionization. How does that work?
Absolutely. All of our communities will benefit when workers are able to make better wages. Workers who make better wages are supportive of the tax base. These are workers who are likely to be able to own their own homes and not be faced with foreclosures. Workers who are in union are more likely to have health care. So all of society benefits when all of our society is prosperous.
Now, let me ask you, what was your background? What drove you to join the labor movement and get involved?
I got involved with the labor movement over 30 years ago as a union organizer. I understood then the importance of workers being able to have a voice in the workplace. One of my first organizing campaigns was with clerical employees in the city of Los Angeles. And over the course of more than 30 years now, I've looked back at those workers that were there, and I have seen them improve their lives economically, and it's just been wonderful, because it's so true that there is certainly an advantage when you are in a union.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at afge.org.
We've been joined by Terry McAuliffe, candidate for governor of Virginia and author of What a Party. Welcome to Inside Government.
Thank you. Great to be with you. Honored to be here today and meet all the AFGE employees and PAC folks and so forth.
Now, you've had quite a history within the Democratic Party, political activists, just about everything. Give us some background. What got you started in politics?
You know, I grew up in Syracuse, New York, and my father was the Onondaga Democratic Party treasurer for years and years. And he literally, from the time I can remember, we began walking, you know, he would go door to door. We'd be doing the leafleting back then, hanging on the door knockers and all that, which was big back then. And, you know, so I was always a political activist as a young man. I was active through college, active after that. I was Jimmy Carter's finance director when I was 23 in his reelect. And, you know, I've had every job you can have in the Democratic Party. I came from a business background, started a bunch of companies, started my first one when I was 14, and then got in a whole variety of businesses. And basically for the last 16 years, I've been pretty much a full-time volunteer fighting. You know, I'm passionate about health care and education, so I've been out there. I've had a lot of tough challenges, had to get our party out of debt for the first time in history, built the National Party's new facility, the new TV, radio, the new headquarters. Built the first voter file for our national party, 178 million name database, which is what Barack Obama just used in all 50 states, and we use in Virginia. But, you know, I think about where do we want to be 10, 20 years from today, and I want to help people. I've had a great life. I'm lucky. Worked hard. Had to do it myself. Luck played a big part in it, and I want to see other people have that same opportunity.
Now, you played a lot of key roles in the Clinton administration with the Clinton family, spokesperson in the last campaign. How did you get involved with
spokesperson, chairman.
How did you get involved doing some of that?
Well, I've been close to the Clinton family for a long time. We're great friends. We actually vacationed together. We've been very close. I served as Bill Clinton's chair in his reelect and was his finance chair. I chaired his convention. I chaired his inaugural. I mean, you know, I've done this all as a volunteer because, you know, I loved what Bill Clinton did. The 22 million new jobs got us out of debt, got us into surplus situation, the Family Medical Leave Act. I mean, you look at all the great things that he did, the greatest economic expansion in our nation's history. But it was an expansion. He, you know, I like to say he created more millionaires and billionaires than any other president ever. But at the same time, more people moved out of poverty. And disposable income for middle-class Americans was an all-time high under his administration. So what I loved about President Clinton is, you know, everybody benefited. And that's what I think is the model that people like to use. And when Hillary ran for president, I was excited. I had known her. I'm very close to Barack Obama. I mean, I knew him. I was chairman of the party when he ran for the Senate. I campaigned with him. And I was chairman of the party in the convention that picked him to give the keynote in 2004. But I had known Hillary for a long time, and I knew she would be a spectacular president. I'm always for someone, never against anybody. And I also, with three young daughters, honestly, I have five children. But with three young daughters, I honestly thought it was time for a woman president of the United States of America. And, you know, I wanted my three daughters to be able to get a bed saying they can do whatever they want to be, including being president of the United States of America. So it was a great campaign, a great primary. Everybody came together at the end, and it was a great victory. For Barack Obama, you know, in Virginia where I live, carried the state for the first time in 44 years.
So you're running for governor. Let's talk a little about that. Is this your first time actually running for office?
Well, you actually run for DNC chair, but it's a much smaller universe, about 500 people. But I've been clearly around having chaired campaigns. I clearly understand it. And for me, there's really no difference. To me, it's not about the person. And people ask me all the time, well, how is it, Terry, for you now? Well, for me, it's really never been about the person, really. It's really been about the issues that they stand for. So for me, the issue set is exactly the same. What I want to do in Virginia, I don't like the idea that we're cutting all this money out of education. I don't believe you raise taxes, and you don't raise taxes in a down economy. We need to focus on how to grow our economy, bringing business in. I have created thousands of jobs. I come from a business background. We got to stimulate the economic activity, new economic growth. Then I can put more money in pre-K, K through 3, help on higher education, fix our roads. They all take money. And if you don't want to cut, you don't want to raise taxes, I think it leaves you one alternative. And I think that's the message of this campaign. We're in the worst economy since the Depression. I think you need someone willing to come in with an executive background who thinks out of the box, like Mark Warner. Mark had never held office before, as you know. Someone would come, maybe has been part of the partisan battles down in Richmond, who's willing to put every big idea and have a discussion. I am not afraid to talk about any issue. I go through this campaign, put big, bold ideas out. If I don't win, my life doesn't change at all. Therefore, I'm not going to say something that's politically expedient. I'm going to say what I think is right and let the chips fall where they may.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at AFGE.org. We've been joined by Brian Moran, who's a candidate for governor of Virginia. Welcome to Inside Government.
Nice to be here with you.
Now, I saw in your background, you've got a little background inside government, having been a prosecutor, which, of course, is my background as well.
Oh, very good.
So
it's a great job. I love being a prosecutor. It mixes public service with... of course, your legal skills, and you're protecting victims, you're righting wrongs. It was the best job I ever had. It was wonderful.
And so you're giving it up to run for governor?
Well, I gave it up to get into the House of Delegates, and I've been a legislator for 12 years now, Democratic leader for 7. But a lot of those skills from the prosecutor's office have benefited me in the public office very much.
And so what really motivated you to get involved, and get involved particularly in politics?
Yeah. Well, of course, I grew up in a family that believed that government could play a positive role in people's lives. And so it was always a discussion around the kitchen table with 7 kids and growing up with Roosevelt Democrat parents. And so it was a matter of, you know, public service. You're trying to make a difference, and you truly have an obligation to leave this world a better place for your children than you found it. And of course, what better way to do that than... in public service, and as a public official and as a delegate, I've tried to do that in the legislature in Virginia, and now we'll do that as governor.
Now, Virginia's been a real changing state. It used to be a very red state. It's becoming much more of a blue state. What do you think is the reason for that?
Well, there's a number of reasons. We now have 2 Democratic senators, a Democratic governor, a majority Democratic congressional delegation, and, of course, voted for President Barack Obama, first time we voted for a Democrat since 1964. I think Democrats have the right message that, we're trying to make those critical investments that improve people's lives, health care, good education, public safety. We're trying to stay away from those issues that divide us. President Bush, for 8 years, it was irresponsible, wealthy corporate dominance of our public policy, and people look for a change. They're looking for somebody who knows what they're going through, and trying to pay the mortgage, trying to keep their job, trying to afford their kids' college tuition. That's why Democrats have been doing well.
I noticed when Governor Mark Warner was governor at that time, it was interesting watching the state legislature and the issue of raising taxes, which has always been considered to be something that's off the table to some extent since the 80s. But even some of the Republicans in Virginia kind of came around, and there was really almost some bipartisanship. Are you finding that the Democrats are maybe able to get along? There's a little more bipartisanship in Virginia?
Well, certainly we want to. I've been in the minority for 7 years, and despite that, I have had a number of legislative successes. I need Republicans to vote for my bills to get them passed, and I've been able to accomplish that. You always try to find common ground, and you try not to make the debates personal, because the next day... you may need their support, so you try not to burn bridges, and you try to find common ground, certainly with respect to public education, children's health insurance, transportation system that we must invest in Virginia to keep our economy strong, that has avoided us to date, but that's something I want to be able to accomplish as governor, that we must invest in our transportation infrastructure, rail, transit, safe bridges, to make sure that Virginia's economy continues to be strong, because we must have job creation and a strong economy.
Do you think, particularly with rail, as you bring it up with Vice President Biden, having been a rail passenger for so long, do you think there's a need for that, like a public-private and state partnership over that, to increase the amount of rail that we have?
Yeah, I mean, one of my top priorities will be high-speed rail from Washington, D.C. to Richmond, our state capital. We should be reaching speeds of 110 miles per hour. That will create a tremendous amount of economic growth, and we should have that on the East Coast. What we need to determine is this is a priority, and then we have to decide how do we finance it. A public-private partnership is perfectly capable of doing that, possibly using some of the economic recovery money that the federal government will be providing the state. So, you know, first you decide what are our priorities, and then you try to find funding mechanisms so that they can become a reality.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at AFGE.org.
It's that time of year again. AFGE's Holiday Bonus Bucks campaign has begun and will run through March 27, 2009. Take advantage of this great opportunity to build your union and earn money and prizes for the holidays. For every coworker you recruit to join AFGE, you'll earn $20 from the National Union and an additional monetary or merchandise incentive from your AFGE district office. And if you recruit five or more members, you'll receive an AFGE briefcase-style Navy canvas bag with leather trim, and your name will automatically be entered into a drawing for a free laptop computer. All the forms and information you'll need are on the AFGE website. Just go to AFGE.org and click on Holiday Bonus Bucks under the Featured Articles section, or call the Membership and Organization Department at 202-639-6410. That's 202-639-6410 or AFGE.org.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at AFGE.org. We've been joined by National Vice President Derek Thomas. Welcome back to Inside Government.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be back.
Let's talk a little about your district. Who do you represent?
Oh, I guess the better question would be, who don't I represent? My district is New York, New England, and New Jersey. So it's every federal agency with the exception of the IRS and the Postal Service.
So you start off at the Canadian border up in Maine and go all the way down to?
All the way down to Cape May in New Jersey.
Okay.
I mean, as far west as Buffalo, New York.
Now, what was your background? How did you get started in federal service?
I actually started out as a service representative with the Social Security Administration back in 1979. Became a shop steward in 1981. From there, you know, vice president of my local, national rep, to MVP.
Now, you've seen through some of those states, also at the state and local level, I guess, working with other unions through central labor councils and state federations, organizing drives. The Employee Free Choice Act has been a big issue for the AFL. How do you feel about that?
I think it's good. I think it's real good. I think we should support it as much as we can. I'm trying to get, you know, our members to understand the importance of it, because, you know, it doesn't really apply to us. But, you know, in the spirit of unity and solidarity, I think it's an excellent, I think it's some excellent legislation.
Now, do you think sometimes, and you hear this as a federal employee, about how people compare federal jobs to private sector jobs, do you think if the private sector had more organizing, more unions, the unions were stronger, they would have similar benefits to what federal employees have, we've obtained for them through AFGE? Like better health care, better retirement?
Would the private sector have it, or would we have it?
Would the private sector start to have more of that, similar to what, because sometimes people in non-union environments talk about, oh, gee, the federal employees have good benefits. Well, they might compared to a non-unionized private sector environment, but when they become unionized, it's very comparable.
You know, I'm one of the ones, you know, during the campaign, President Obama, then Senator Obama, kept saying, I think every American should have the same health insurance that members of Congress get. You know, and I go, it's not that great of a plan. You know, I mean, it's a plan, which, of course, beats not having anything. But in looking at health insurance and what our members have to pay, I just think that we need an administration that's going to take advantage of, you know, a 2 million-person workforce and work for better premiums, better coverage. So, you know, that's how I look at it. I mean, we have a plan, but... You know, most of my members, when I talk to them, they say, well, yeah, when I talk about the pay increase, they go, well, yeah, my health insurance premiums already killed that. So in terms of health insurance, I think we just have to look at, and I know he is looking at revamping and reforming the whole system. So I don't know if that answered your question. probably not.
Well, let's talk about Social Security for a minute, too. You come out of the Social Security Administration.
Yes.
And it seems like over the years there have been a lot of cutbacks over the past 8 years, which have made it longer and longer for people to get disability, Social Security, and things like that. As somebody who's done claims and been involved in that, you interact and talk to folks. What are they thinking? What are they feeling on the ground?
I mean, the employees?
Yeah.
Our members of Social Security? They're very, very frustrated, very angry. So I started with Social Security in 1979, and one of the things that they keep talking about, the baby boomer generation about to retire, the impact on the Social Security fund, and I go, yeah, not to mention that you don't have enough employees to process the claims, which I really don't understand. If you know that you're going to get hit with this huge flow of retirees, why would you cut workers in Social Security?
I know they've been talking a lot about trying to do more with computers and technology sort of thing. But
I think that's one of the, maybe 20, 30 years from now, when a large generation who preceded, the information technology, when most of them are gone, maybe everyone coming after that can are more computer literate than most of the folks in my generation. The other problem is that they keep pushing this thing, but once you make a mistake online, it's a nightmare trying to get it corrected. So the technology is good, but you need the employees to guide people through the process, to help them through it, and to make sure that it's done correctly.
And even if you are able to file something, online, somebody's got to be there at the other end of the computer reading it, editing it, giving you feedback.
Exactly. And as I said, I was talking with someone from Social Security a couple of weeks ago, and they were saying, well, yeah, they could do stuff online, but, once they make a mistake, it's a nightmare, because there is no one that you can go to and say, well, what do I do now? You're going through this whole computer process that doesn't help. So,
and I'm trying to think of my 90-year-old grandfather trying to to do all this online when he's never really been much online before. If they're going to put people in, make that the priority, I could see that being a real problem.
You don't even have to go that far. Think of a 40-year-old worker who becomes disabled. They have to go through the same process.
And file for disability while they're going through all of this.
Exactly. Which can be a very, very frustrating process. So, this whole movement away from, not hiring people to process these claims is just really... it's the whole... sometimes I think it's like we'll make it so bad that we have to get rid of it. The whole starve the beast philosophy. The most efficient run agency in the federal government uses like less than 1% or maybe 1% of the total trust fund in administrative costs. And they're still trying to kill it. So,
do you think if there were more outreach workers almost, folks that could go and be trained to help folks in the initial filing, that would cut down maybe some of the backlog? If we addressed it early on as opposed to later in the process?
You mean like Social Security employees?
If they hired more folks, on the front end.
Yeah. I think, I don't even know that when I worked with Social Security, they had field reps that would go to people's homes who couldn't get out, file their claims, do the follow-up on it. I think they cut back substantially on that. It's just all part of the whole anti-government philosophy that we've been going through since 1981. The government is the problem, not the solution philosophy.
Now, we've spent a good deal of time actually over the past year together, you and I. We were out in Denver and watched what happened out there at the convention and then with the inaugural and things going on around that. How has that made you feel? How are you feeling about watching this past year?
I feel really, really upbeat. I cannot remember the last time in my adult life when I felt this good about the direction the country can move in. I just feel, and every day, I just think that we've made the step in the right direction by electing, President Obama and Vice President Biden. But as I've been telling my members over the last couple of months, this is not the end of the journey, it's the beginning. And I'm reminded of, you probably heard the story, I forget which, some interest groups in Roosevelt's first term, they came to meet with him, and they gave this list of things that they wanted. He said, I agree with that, and I'll give you that, now make me do it. And I think that's what people have to understand. The president can be for you still have to make them do it. They still have other priorities. So I just don't want us to back down and say, okay, No, Obama's in, we can take a breath. No, we take a breath and keep pushing forward. I mean, the only difference is now we have a friendly ear in the White House as opposed to someone who was just deaf to us.
And really, that's a big change. I mean, over 8 years of having people in charge of the government who seemed not committed to the mission of many of the agencies, that maybe now we're seeing people coming in that actually are committed, say, to the Department of Labor, committed to cleaning up the environment, things like that. Are you finding
taking care of our veterans? Yeah.
Are the members reacting to that? I mean, as you talk to folks in your area?
Yeah, they are. They are. I was up in Boston 3 weeks ago doing an organizing drive with EPA. I had an opportunity to talk, and really, I was really happy. I had an opportunity to speak to a group of about 20 interns, yeah, for the EPA, and got called in at the last minute, and I was just, because I think there's two things. You know, we need more young people in the government, but we also need them in the labor movement, you know, in a diverse group. And these people were really excited. I talked to some of them after the luncheon, and I was like, well, so what's this going to be like? No, we want to work for EPA. You know, we want to work for the government. We want to do good. That is so. Compared to 5 years ago, I went to Rutgers, at Rutgers Labor Education Center, and I spoke to a group of students who the last thing they wanted to do was come to work for the federal government. Federal, are you kidding me? You know, so this is like a sea change in terms of everyone's attitude. So it's good. We just have to capitalize on it. We don't give up now.
And are you finding also with people that are in the labor movement, the concept of organizing is sort of changing? I mean, I can remember Rudy Giuliani at the Republican convention kind of demeaning the idea of community organizing, but labor organizing is kind of similar in many ways. I mean, bringing people together over common goals and interests. Are you finding there's an interest in people going out and doing that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, one of my favorite, I think at the Republican National Convention when Palin said, I mean, what's a community organizer do? She knows now, right? She won't be. I think everyone's kind of like, wow. So, yeah, I was at a meeting with the New York City Central Labor Council and Cornell University, a labor advisory group, and the feeling in that room about we have to get back to organizing, you know, and mobilizing people. You really have, opportunities like this come along maybe once every 20 years where you actually have a leader that people believe in, that they want to believe in, you know, so we have to capitalize on it. Not just recruit new members, but organize them, mobilize them, you know, keep it moving. We have elections next year, 2010. We see what's happening with the stimulus package already. I mean, these diehards from, as MVP Swonky would say, you know, these Stone Age Neanderthals who, you know, just hate government.
And we'll bring them along both in the public sector, but also with the Employee Free Choice Act in the private sector, too.
Absolutely, absolutely. They need to that just needs to pass. It really just needs to pass. I've read some horror stories about what happens in the private sector with elections and or the absence of them, or even when the union wins an election. You know, it's not just the Employee Free Choice Act and the right to, you know, the sign, the cards to record union recognition, but it's the mandatory arbitration after, you know, 1 year of no contract. All of that stuff, it just it shifts the balance of power. So, and that's what we need.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at AFGE.org.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at AFGE.org. We've been joined by Paul Ferris, who's local president from down in Texas. Welcome to Inside Government.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here. We're down from El Paso, Texas at the Army Hospital. Having a great time down there. A lot of good things are happening. BRAC is alive and well. We're building and all the troops are coming back. Thank God they're coming back mainly safe. But it's a great time for federal employees and our country.
And when we talk about Army hospitals, most people think the VA, but the Army itself also runs some hospitals. So in what stage do you all get involved?
We are a military hospital. We take care of our active duty, the retirees, the dependents. However, we are joined with the VA, and so we get a lot of their folks to come over, and we take care of them because we have a lot more resources than what they have, the doctors, the active duty, and such. So it's an ongoing expansion of roles because we also have a Soldier Family Medical Center, a medical clinic outside on Fort Bliss, and then also on Biggs because, as I said, we're expanding, and we're taking care of all the families out there.
Now, how are you part of Fort Bliss, or are you right outside Fort Bliss, or how does it work down there in El Paso?
It's kind of unusual. Fort Bliss is Fort Bliss proper, and we have a clinic out that way. We have the hospital, which is considered Fort Bliss as far as the mail and maybe the Army property, but we are not technically on the property of Fort Bliss, about a couple miles off the post. And then we have Biggs Army Airfield, which is another few miles down the road. But we're hoping to get a new facility and put everything together. I remember the old hospital. It was spread out all over back in the 1940s. It was quite a sight to see. The hospital was not one building.
And how many folks work in the hospital where you're at?
That's a good question. We're trying to get all that information from management. sometimes we hear different stories, but we're trying to do the best we can. We're having some tough times getting folks online and get them hired for some reason or another. There's delays, but we've got to make sure that we take care of our troops, and we do that by bringing in the amount of people we need, like our warrior transition units. We need our folks to be able to the mental health, and then you need to have doctors to take care of the wounded guys coming back, and you just don't turn off war the minute you get home. And we have to remember that we are a family, and I know we at Local 2516 in El Paso believe that wholeheartedly, and I know AFG does the same, that we look at our soldiers, our employees as one family, because when we're out there driving on the streets, it doesn't matter who's behind that wheel. If they're drunk, it's not going to matter whether you're civilian or military. But we got some guys out there that need help. And if we don't stick together as a family, a lot of people are going to be hurt.
Now, you all also provide medical care to the families of the dependents, the soldiers?
Yes, we do. We have pediatrics. We have geriatrics, oncology. We have surgery. We have a lot of our docs that are coming back and forth from Iraq, so they've, you know, the surgeries they've done over there, this is now a walk in the park, so to speak. But we take care of them from birth, cradle to crib, I guess. Or no, what's the old saying?
Cradle to grave.
Grave, that's the one. Not cradle to crib. It's not going anywhere.
Now, are some of these civilian folks that are getting deployed over there in terms of the medical personnel?
No, not very many of them. Some of them are reserves, so in that capacity they are. We do have a few civilians that are requesting to be deployed over there, and they're medical professionals. You've got nurses and doctors with the skills, critical skills, the emergency room, and that's what you need over there in that zone.
And that's a point that I think is sometimes forgotten, is that the civilian personnel at DOD sometimes do get deployed overseas, and you've had that certainly with the medical personnel that you've got. Couple nurses at least, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. You know, everybody has a dedication. This is our country, and as I said, we're family up there. Most of the folks in at our hospital are retirees or family members of active duty or veterans or combat veterans. So we have a direct connection to these guys coming back, and they're our friends, and we want to take care of them. So a lot of folks, if we're able to go overseas, why not? I think it's only right that we go over there and let the 21-year-olds be 21-year-olds here in the United States, and us older guys go over there and take their place.
Let's talk a little about during the 8 years of Bush, we had the National Security Personnel System, NSPS. How did that affect morale with some of the folks in your local when they started hearing about that kind of performance plan?
Well, it was great. The way management presented it, it was a fantastic program. And then we came along as a union and started educating folks on the truth. And slowly, over the ridicule that I received, people started listening and believing it. And when I showed the documents from the United States Army that plainly said you would be deployed or could be deployed, people started changing their minds. And when I would talk to management officials about why aren't you telling the truth, so we are. We're telling them the truth, Paul. And I said, no, what you're telling them is a slight variation of the truth. You don't give them the whole story. Tell them that they can be deployed. Don't brush over it. Let them know that they may not receive their monies. Actually, NSPS has been good for the unions because our membership went up. People understood they couldn't fight it alone. And when I talk to folks, I often remind them that I don't stand by myself. I stand with thousands of folks behind me and the laws. And if you have an NSPS system, I think it's dangerous for America. You're helping the enemy and self-interest, and it's the worst thing that this country could even look at having.
Now, let me ask you, how did you get involved working for DOD? What brought you to federal employment?
I was in the military, and I ended up staying in El Paso, loved it, enjoy the family atmosphere. My wife was not crazy about being in the military, traveling, so I flipped a coin and said, well, I can either travel the world and be in the military or stay local. So I stayed local.
And what was your training or background in?
I was a combat medic and enjoyed that and went on and became an EMT and then worked the wards and emergency room. Now I'm doing a full-time representation, trying to keep folks out of trouble and helping management to be successful in the mission. We have to understand that we are a team. We have a goal in mind, and that's to take care of our patients. And in the medical field, that's very important. And that's what we try to get across to the military folks because they haven't worked with civilians. So we try to work together as a team, as a family, in unity.
Now, let me ask you, you say you were a combat medic. What years were you enlisted?
You know you're not supposed to ask a gentleman those kind of questions, but this yesterday is a while back. But I had
were you involved in theater?
No,
during
I wasn't, and that was very difficult for me not to be able to go out and do the things that I wanted to do for my country. I feel I know combat is not something that people would want to do, and anybody that's been in combat would not want to be there, but I feel that I was not the best American I could have been because I didn't get an opportunity to fight for the freedoms that so many people have fought for this country. And so it's difficult. I guess being a DOD employee is one way to keep helping.
And what brought you to AFGE?
I don't know. I really don't know. I've always spoke up for people. Things are wrong. I just did it because it was the right thing to do, and slowly I got asked to join, and I did, and the rest is what it is. It's just a vehicle to do the right thing so that we can take care of folks.
And you started out just as a member, and then did you become a shop steward?
I became a member, and then some things happened, and I became the first vice president, and more transition, and now I became the president. And through that process, I've just learned how to do AFGE business and union business and taking care of the folks.
And how long have you been a local president?
I think about 5 or 6 years. It goes by like a quick stop clock. Yeah.
And have you had experience doing a lot of collective bargaining at this point now?
We've done a couple contracts. And you learn, the first time was very peaceful with management. We had a very, I would say, pro-organization management, meaning management and the union, we both went to a training session together to learn how together to come together on a contract. This last time it was more adversarial. We could have offered a glass of water and they would have said no, you know, in the desert. It was like, what are you guys doing? You know, why can't we be a team? Why can't we work together? And it just didn't make sense. And what was sad was some of the players on management team, in the next month or two, they were going to be gone. They were not going to even be a part of this contract, but it didn't matter what kind of destruction they were willing to put on it. And what's one of the sad things is one of the chief negotiators for the management a career soldier, nurse, lieutenant colonel. When she got orders to go to fight for her country that had just paid her for over 20 years, she dropped her retirement papers. And I knew what kind of person she was at that time, but yet management still had her on the team.
Now, you know, if you go back during the Clinton administration, one of the things that they seemed to be very proud of was working with unions in what they called partnership, which was outside of the actual collective bargaining process. Do you think there'd be an advantage to having some kind of partnership-type program where you could meet with management, maybe even higher-level management, on a regular basis, not while a contract was adversarial being negotiated, but just a chance to talk in general about issues of concern?
Oh, absolutely. That's what we try to do now. We try to work together, partnership. It's like a marriage. If you can't communicate with each other, it's going to dissolve. In the same way, the stakes are much bigger. We're looking at our national security. We're looking at our future. We're looking at our country. We're looking at hope for all America and the world.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFG's Inside Government, available on demand at afge.org.
It's that time of year again. AFGE's Holiday Bonus Bucks campaign has begun and will run through March 27th, 2009. Take advantage of this great opportunity to build your union and earn money and prizes for the holidays. For every coworker you recruit to join AFGE, you'll earn $20 from the National Union and an additional monetary or merchandise incentive from your AFGE district office. And if you recruit five or more members, you'll receive an AFGE briefcase-style navy canvas bag with leather trim, and your name will automatically be entered into a drawing for a free laptop computer. All the forms and information you'll need are on the AFGE website. Just go to afge.org and click on Holiday Bonus Bucks under the Featured Articles section, or call the Membership and Organization Department at 202-639-6410. That's 202-639-6410, or afge.org.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at afge.org. We've been joined by Robert McNeil, Local 237 President. Welcome to Inside Government.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about Local 237. Who do you all represent?
We represent the transportation security offices in Providence and Bradley, Connecticut.
And how large is the local? How many folks are up there?
Right now we have about 167 members out of approximately 190 at the airport.
And what are some of the issues up there? Uniforms, I think, was a concern for some folks.
Uniforms has been an issue since the new uniforms have come out. People are developing rashes from them. And the whole process to exchange and get new uniforms has been an ongoing process, with them taking 6 to 8 weeks for people to get new uniforms.
Now, what was the problem with the uniforms?
What we've been told is that the resin that was in the dye for the uniforms is made from a formaldehyde that's used in countries outside the United States, as in Honduras and Mexico. That's where most of the problems have come from.
So these weren't American-made uniforms?
No, not one piece of our uniform product is made in America. Our belts are made in Canada, our pants are made in Mexico, and our shirts are made in Mexico or Honduras.
And what kind of new uniforms are they moving towards?
They're trying to move towards a 100% cotton uniform that would be made in the U.S.
And when did this first come to light? What were people feeling when they tried on the new uniforms?
That they're getting heavy rashes, lightheadedness, dizzy, puffy lips, redness in the cheeks. The rashes are really bad on the necks and if you're wearing the long sleeve shirts at all.
And what happened as that started to come about? Did the union do something with that?
Well, the union had told us to have people fill out CA-1s, which the airports were refusing to do. So then after prodding by AFG in a letter to the Congressman Bernie...
Okay, well...
Bernie, the committee chairman of the Homeland Security, he sent a letter...
Thompson.
Bernie Thompson. He sent a letter to the administrator of TSA to ask him why this is not being taken care of in a prudent manner. And I have not received any information since then. But I know now that it's taken 8 weeks for people to get it, so they either have to wear the old uniform, which is causing them rashes, or if they still have the old uniform, they are allowed to wear them.
Now, is this something that if we had collective bargaining for TSO, something you could sit down, talk about in a formalized way?
Yes, because right now, the only policies that TSA will listen to is their own. They have no other oversight other than their own policies. They don't have to listen. They don't choose to listen to us.
Now, that's a pretty large number of folks you mentioned in your bargaining unit that have already joined even without collective bargaining. What are some of the issues that people are concerned about?
People are concerned about the unfairness of promotions, attendance policies, just having a general protection for a voice to Congress.
Now, one of the issues, scheduling, from what I heard from some TSOs, some schedules are set up where there's like long periods of time between like a morning and afternoon shift, but not enough time to go home, those kind of things.
Right. They have a split shift where they provide an incentive, they say, of 6-8% pay differential between the two shifts. They only allow either 2 or 3 hours between them breaks. It's not an incentive, and it's not cost effective for the government to run that program, that type of incentive program. You're talking about 8% of somebody's base pay, to where all you're doing is you're causing a shortage of personnel actually between them 3 hours of where it's there. Scheduling is I have always seen a problem. I've been with TSA for 7 years because they don't handle it well. They try to minimize the number of people that are there during the short hours, which we could understand, but it doesn't work. It would never work in a workforce that size.
Now, before you came to TSA, where did you work before that?
I used to work for Chemical Bank in New York, and I worked for Credit Collection Services.
Have you noticed that a lot of the folks that seem to work as TSOs have come out of maybe a law enforcement background or that kind of thing?
A lot of people that work from the TSA workforce are veterans, former police officers, former firefighters.
Then we obviously at AFG have a lot of experience representing law enforcement folks, people that work at corrections, people that work at the VA in 24-hour facilities. Some of these scheduling kind of issues, it seems like would work better if you actually sat down with the people that are affected and set up some shifts that are workable.
We've understood that as TSOs. We've tried to bring them ideas forward. We will not be heard by management. They believe that they have all the cards, they have all the power, and they believe it's take it or leave it. And they've actually told people that if you don't like it, you can leave.
Now, there's supposed to be some change in the air. Changes coming, changes here. What kind of change are you looking forward to seeing?
We're looking forward to having the right to be represented by a union. We're looking for to get our collective bargaining rights to where we can have a disciplinary system that's fair. It's not just a one-sided position. Right now, our disciplinary system works that we have a two-step grievance. We can grieve a discipline action to the person who gave us the discipline, and then to that next person's supervisor, who usually was the one who told them to write us up, because the incompetency in management at TSA is unbelievable. You have supervisors, but then you want to keep their hands and legs tied so they can't do anything on their own. So you never get a fair hearing anywhere there.
Now, what are the reasons a lot of people are joining AFGE at this point? Because obviously we don't have collective bargaining yet, but we're in the process of moving towards that with this change. What kinds of benefits do people see in joining AFGE right now?
Right now, the benefits are the Union Plus benefits, the benefits of having someone to be able to tell what their problems are, too, so we can they understand there are power in numbers. And the more TSOs that we have signed up across the country, the louder our voice is going to become, to where maybe the administrator, who was Kip Hawkley, we don't know who the next one's going to be, but maybe they will take what we're doing seriously. Because until they take it seriously, it's not going to change.
Now, did you all see any letters or any information coming from the Obama campaign when they were campaigning about this issue?
Yes, we received. There was a letter that came out on October 20th stating that Obama does support the TSO's rights to collective bargaining, and he believes that the PASS system, if it is not a true, fair, and transparent system, which it is not, should be abolished and changed to a GS system. And that letter is one of the reasons why we've been having so many TSOs sign up, because they know that change is coming, and the pay-for-performance system pass that they use, there is no way that system can be ever called fair or transparent.
And did you sense some excitement amongst the folks you work with once that letter came out?
Yes. Everybody wanted that letter. Everybody wanted to see that letter. Everyone believes in that letter because they knew that change was coming. And they knew that President Obama, then candidate Obama, would fulfill his campaign promises to us.
Did that make a difference in how some people were voting when you talked about that?
It did. People who have not always been on the Democratic side of the House, they looked at it as we need these protections now, especially in the times in the economy that we live in. And that they came over to the other side. We've had a lot of people get out for walking and talking campaigns in my local. And we wanted to make a difference. We wanted to be making known.
And it seemed unusual that, you know, when you look at the folks that the Bush administration were going after, folks who worked at DOD, who tended to maybe be not the most left-leaning people in the union. The TSOs, many of them, as we said, came out of law enforcement. Again, not your most left-leaning folks, but yet those were the people that almost seemed to be targeted with personnel systems to take away rights from people who are protecting America.
That's right, and people do not need to be, if they're trying to do a job, they shouldn't have to worry about their pay performance, their benefits, if they're going to be disciplined, if they're sitting the wrong way or looking the wrong way. Their mind needs to be on their job all the time. Our job is to make sure that they have that protection in place where they don't have to worry about it. And that's what we're hoping the union will do for ours.
And then, of course, one of the big issues recently has been whistleblower rights and trying to get whistleblower rights for TSOs. And it almost seems shocking that in an agency where you'd be concerned about issues and you'd, if there were problems, you'd want to know about them, that you all didn't have whistleblowing rights.
Well, here's what the big issue with that is. Management has whistleblower rights. The TSO workforce does not. That was written in the policy that way, that the management would have, not the TSOs.
So if management was doing something wrong, it made it almost impossible for the frontline TSOs to blow the whistle on it.
Exactly, out of fear of retaliation. It's just like DHS sent out an email recently that we had to have no fear training before February 28th. And I was asking in the training department, why are you giving us whistleblower protections training when we don't have whistleblower protections? They couldn't give me an answer for that.
Maybe they knew it was on the way?
I hope they do. I hope they realize that.
And are you finding that people are going to be excited about this? I mean, your local sounds like it's pretty well organized. I mean, are people getting ready for having collective bargaining?
People are very, very, very excited about this. They've been dealing with a pay. I have a TSO who I talked with last Thursday. He's been with TSA for 7 years. He's gotten a raise 1 year. Out of 7 years. They are very excited about this because we need to get away from the because I said so and take it or leave it policies that TSA's been having.
Obviously, you get out to some of the meetings beyond just the local with AFGE and other TSOs. Are you finding the same kind of enthusiasm in other locals and around the country?
Oh, yes. I speak to a lot of local presidents across the country, and it's the same thing right now. It's just going larger and larger. It's getting bigger and bigger. More people are getting excited about it. It's time for us to come together and join up all 43,000 members.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt-Baker, Virginia gubernatorial candidates Terry McAuliffe and Brian Moran, AFGE District 2 National Vice President Derek Thomas, and AFGE Local Presidents Paul Ferris and Robert McNeil. Also, thank you to AFGE Local 987, for bringing you Inside Government on News Talk 940 WMAC in Macon, Georgia. And thank you to AFGE Local 1592 for bringing you Inside Government on KSL News Radio in Salt Lake City, Utah. And that's The View from Inside Government.